Hub
and Spoke
Audio Collective.
In fourth grade, I had a young teacher who wore pantsuits and tall red shoes, who feathered her frost-tipped hair and applied makeup as if it were tempera paint.
This is Julie Sedevi. She's reading from her memoir, Linguophile, A Life of Language Love.
At the end of each day, she had all the girls line up at the door to kiss her cheek before releasing us into the clean outdoor air. I demurred. The only kissing I had ever done had been of skin that was not lacquered over, of faces that had not been doctored for public presentation, because I was not the public. The fake intimacy of the whole thing made me squirm. After tolerating several days of my resistance, during which I would take my place in line but slink past the teacher with eyes downcast, she sighed heavily and announced with loud, simulated sorrow, "Julie doesn't like me." Which was a true statement, actually. But what I heard was an imperative sentence. I lifted my face to kiss the cheek.
Whew, now that's a great school experience, branded in memory. Icky, and also bewildering. Did Julie feel defeated by kissing her teacher? Or was it an act of defiance? And the teacher, how did she feel? When Julie thinks back about this episode, she asks herself another question. Why didn't either she or her teacher just say to each other what they meant?
What I meant was, please don't make me kiss you. But I said nothing. I averted my gaze and tried to evade her dolled up body, which was unfortunately occupying most of the doorway. What my teacher said was, Julie doesn't like me. A statement that incidentally I meant but could not say. What she meant was, kissing me is obligatory. A statement she probably could not say. As I saw it, only one of us was permitted the luxury of misunderstanding the other.
From Quiet Juice, this is Subtitle, a podcast about languages and the people who speak them. Today, a conversation with language writer Julie Sedevi, who's written a kind of natural history of language as she has encountered it in her own life. At home, in school, in love, and in death.
I have no memory of the first time I understood that clumps of sound could contain the thoughts of others. But I have watched meaning sunrise on the faces of my own babies as I held them and pointed out the essential components of their world. Rabbit, daddy, shoe, milk, toes, nose. Their heads swiveling to follow mine. Their mouths stone still with concentration. And I'm sure that it was like this for me too, sitting on your knee, mother, and scanning your face, following your gaze like the searchlight that it was. My most important work then was to merge my mind and attention with yours.
Julie Sedevi, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, from that excerpt near the beginning of your book, it sounds like the words themselves, the rabbit and shoe and milk, they're perhaps less important, or the meaning of them may be less important than the connection that you're making to your mother by just using those words.
I think to some extent that's true, and certainly that's true for what precedes language. I think if you look at small babies who have no words at all, and who maybe don't even yet know what words are or that words convey meanings, there's a drive to have some sort of interaction where You're locking eye gaze. Maybe you're looking at the same thing together. And by the time that children are ready to extract something out of the stream of language, I think those abilities to interact and connect are already very firmly established. And to me, that's really what allows us to acquire language in the first place. So you see little children doing this when they have rudimentary syllables. My son would point to things that he saw that interested him and say, da, da. And that was just his general purpose way of saying, notice this with me. So yes, I think that connection is very powerful.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking back now to the first noises and words that my daughter said to us. And an early one was blueberry, that was very difficult for her to say. So it didn't come out that way at all. But it was really important to her because she had heard us saying those words to her and showing her what the things were. Mm-hmm. And so there seemed to be that combination of a kind of melding of the minds over what these objects were. But the communication itself that drew parents and child together was as important, if not more.
Yeah, and I find it so interesting that a huge number of verbalizations by children who are learning their very first words are not necessarily to convey information or to communicate a need that I want filled by you right now. It really often is just this, oh, I want you to have some experience that I'm having right now. I want us to have this experience together. And I remember when I was first reading about these attempts to teach signs to chimpanzees, that this is one of the things that really was a striking difference between how chimps use signs to communicate versus how children use language to communicate. The chimps would almost always use the signs to get something that they wanted, to get some kind of food, to remove an obstacle. But that's not what seems to be the primary motivation of children in using their very first words. When I was 12, I asked my mother if I was pretty. She looked at me and considered. It's more important to be smart than to be pretty, she said. This exchange is an apt summary of our relationship at the time. I spent my adolescence convinced that I was ugly. When my mother said that it was more important to be smart than to be pretty, that was not a lie. She had committed no violation of language. So who or what was responsible for the injury that ensued? I recently asked my mother what she'd had in mind that day she told me, her 12-year-old daughter, in response to the question at hand, a question that I had asked with my heart in my mouth, that it was more important to be smart than to be pretty. Exactly that, she said. I should have taken refuge in the literalness of her words. I should not have stepped out onto the snow. But I did. And the fall I took, where the solidity of language left an opening, was deep. Very deep.
So, on the face of it, it seems to me that your mother should have understood that this was an incredibly sensitive thing for you. Mm. And said, you know, yes, you're pretty, you're beautiful. Is that your sense?
Well, I think at the time, that's what I felt I needed. And I think that question was not just a question about whether I was actually pretty. I think there was a lot more that was packed into that question. There was also a question that I wasn't maybe able to articulate quite yet that had to do with my understanding or my belief that your worth as a young girl was evaluated on the basis of your beauty, and how do you function in a world like that? And this was just one of those instances where the communicative act was rich and loaded and laden, and where exactly the wrong thing to do was simply to attend to each other's words. In my mother's case, to just literally answer that question with a very factual answer or something that, you know, expressed a true belief that she had. And my mistake was to read a tremendous amount into her response. First of all, that she didn't think that I was pretty. And secondly, that this meant that she didn't think I was a valuable person. So all of these layers were going on under the surface. And in the book, I use the metaphor of crevasses as a way of explaining that underneath the surface of language, the surface is like a layer of snow on top of a glacier that hides all of these gaps. And that if we're not attentive to the presence of these gaps, we can just punch right through the snow and fall into these crevasses with sometimes dire effects.
Which maybe both you and your mom were doing at the same time.
That's right. And now, of course, I have a very different perspective because I understand that the reason she couldn't read my question for what it was is that her experience of adolescence was completely different from mine. She had grown up in communist Czechoslovakia, which was not a consumer-based society. So unlike me, she was not exposed to all of the barrage of messages that I got, that, you know, from sources that were trying to sell me products or sell me some ideal of what I should look like, what I should buy, how I should transform myself. She grew up in a society where you basically just wore whatever hand-me-down clothes were available because there was nothing to buy in the stores. There was, you know, no lip gloss available. So the value that was placed on a girl's appearance was not at all the same as it was in a very consumer-based North American society. As an adult, I can see how her world led to an interpretation or a misinterpretation that was so out of line with mine. But at the time that I was 12, I did not have the capacity to see that. And she didn't have the experience to really understand what my question was after.
Right. I mean, it's difficult. It's your mother. And I mean, we generally don't allow our mothers to be rational when we want them to be loving. it's the nature of the relationship, especially, as you say, at the age of 12.
You know, in retrospect, I truly appreciate my mother's rational personality. I really do.
After the break, pleasure and loss. Julie's personal history of language continues. What the heck's going on with Subtitle? Where are the new episodes, you may ask? Okay, here's the deal. Kavita and I are working on a big project, which is going to see the light of day next year. Yes, 2027. It's going to be worth the wait, I promise. In the meantime, there's our newsletter. If you like language, you really should have our newsletter in your feed to subscribe. And it's free, of course. Go to subtitlepod.com/newsletter. As for new episodes, we'll put out a few this year when interesting stuff comes along. But rest assured, we're working on that much larger project, which is going to generate a whole bunch of new episodes next year. And there's another reason for the audio silence. I moved from the East Coast of the US to the West Coast, like drove across the country. It was, of course, epic. The whole family, belongings, dog. So there's been that. Kavita and I chat online at the oddest times now. We used to run into each other at the grocery store in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But now she's in Finland, been there for a few years, and I'm 10 hours behind in California. There's one thing I regret from our road trip. We didn't have time to make a detour north of the border to the Canadian West, where the subject of this episode, Julie Sedavy, lives. Some other time. Back now to Julie.
My private history of language resides in my body. It is flagrantly oral. All of its pleasures have come to me through the movements of mouth and tongue, and from the mind's reconstruction of such gestures, derived from the waves of sound lapping against my ears. Oral language has tuned my attention to what is happening in my mouth. Ever since I lay as an infant in my crib, playing with my vocal apparatus, patiently recreating the sounds made by the speaking beings around me. I played at degrees of lip rounding. I raised or lowered the tongue, pulled it toward the back of my mouth or extended it forward. I pushed air out through narrow channels into turbulences of sound, or stopped air short with lips or tongue, or let it flow unimpeded while I performed experiments in shaping the resonant cavity through which the flow of air passed. All of this is to say that, for me, there is no language pleasure without mouthfeel. I use the word speech to try to contain this pleasure.
I just absolutely love that description. I mean, it really made me think about the essential nature of language, because I think in the past I've always compartmentalized sensual language as opposed to everyday language, which is dull and boring. And it seems that you're making a bigger claim that language is inherently sensual and that that plays a role in our desire to learn it and keep speaking it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it certainly is. And I think that may be a byproduct of the fact that I happened to have been rolled around in many different languages at a very young age, and perhaps that tuned my attention to the sounds of language in a particular way. We have a tendency to think of language as this very abstract thing, this code that we use for the purpose of conveying information. And certainly, you know, now that we see the advent of language models in artificial intelligence, that is seems to be a default way of thinking about language. But of course, artificial language models are disembodied. They have no experience of speech in the way that we do. And I think that there is something very real to our experience of language as having emerged from our bodies. It's the way that we recruit the bodily tools that we have at our disposal. I think there's, you know, very interesting research that's coming out that suggests that the meanings that we attribute to words are not so cleanly separate, for example, from the sounds or the what the mouth is doing as it produces these sounds. So across languages, for instance, words that convey small size often are using the vowel e or I. So you think of teeny, tiny, or itsy bitty. This is prevalent across a number of different languages. And if you think of what's happening in your mouth when you say the sound e, it's a very constricted, narrow channel through which the air is flowing, as opposed to if you say the word ah, your mouth is now wide open and there's a largeness to the oral cavity. You know, there's interesting evidence that we don't ignore these elements of sound and mouthfeel in the way that we respond to language.
Your book is divided into three parts, which you describe as childhood, maturity, and loss. And in the loss part, yeah, there is a lot of linguistic loss. But I also took some of the stories to be about it, more like a lifetime of accumulated language and knowledge, accumulated knowledge about language, and how it can be both deeply pleasurable and deeply inadequate, sometimes all at the same time. And the stories about the people you've lost that you describe, your father and your brother, really brings those things out. In your brother Vac's final weeks, you're there with him, with his best friend Oliver. And I wonder, was Vac losing his ability to speak or any other aspect of language at that
time? Yeah, he declined quite rapidly. He had end-stage pancreatic cancer. And really, over the course of about 3 days, he took a very, very sharp turn for the worse. And during that period, he said very little. He spoke mostly in very short utterances. At times, he was delirious. So there were moments when it was clear he was in a reality that was a little bit different from ours. I remember at one time he said with great urgency, "Have we finished the move yet? Have we finished the move yet?" Which I felt was really poignant, and I reassured him almost. But yeah, his ability to attend to us and be aware of us, I think, was very clearly there right up until the end.
And then after he died, you and Oliver made several hours of audio recordings, mm-hmm. the two of you narrating your experience of his last days.
Mm-hmm.
What made you do that?
Well, because it was surprisingly such an intensely beautiful experience that we felt a need to capture. This was the first time that I had been at anyone's deathbed. And that whole experience was filled with so much closeness and connection and love and presence throughout that whole period. Even as we knew Vac was fading away, we also felt his presence with us in such a powerful and intense way. And we wanted to capture something about what those days felt like. And I'm really, really glad we did. I at least have gone back and listened to it a number of times as a way of bringing me back into that space of just leaning in so close. There was such an intimacy to that experience. You know, when you had me read that passage of an interaction with a small child where you're focused on the child learning the meanings of new words, that too has, I think, a similar intimacy in that experience, that you are just two people who are paying such close attention to each other, reading each other's signals so closely, because in a way there's so little language to go with. It's almost like as the language falls away, the distraction of that code causes you to into an attentional state that has a different quality. And there was something really profound and beautiful about that.
You mentioned one particular recording or recording of one particular day that you listened to the most.
Yeah, it was really my brother's last moments, which to me encapsulated his entire life in the months leading up to his death. As soon as I learned of his diagnosis, I would spend many hours talking with him on the phone while he was still very articulate. And what really struck me is how in those months he kept turning over in his mind and verbalizing to me the stories that showed to him how much love he had experienced over the course of his lifetime. That was clearly what he wanted to hold on to, what he most wanted to express in his last months. And I felt that that part of Vac is absolutely what he retained right up until the very, very last moments and the very last little tiny bit of language that he had left, was that preoccupation with his relationships and with expressing gratitude for having received love and his desire to give love right up to the very end.
So here's the passage from Julie's book where she's talking about that last audio recording on Vac's final day. Julie says in that recording, you can hear Oliver, Vac's best friend. You can hear him reciting every shared memory he could remember of him and Vac from the day they met in junior high school to the present time. When Oliver finishes telling Vac of these times together, he just starts again, reciting the same memories. As Julie listens, she wonders how much of this Vac is taking in.
Was Vec able to travel with Oliver through the lines of these stories? In those final moments before he surrendered his last remnant of language and the last of his own separate human life? It doesn't matter. In the end, Vec knew that all of language could be melted down, cooled, and poured into a single syllable. Love. In response to Oliver's recitations, he offered up the word, repeated over and over again. Love. 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 And Oliver sent it back to him. Love. Yeah, Vec. Love. And Vec responded, love. Love. And this is all I need. This is how Vec left me with everything I needed to face my life without him. With everything I need each day to withstand the terrors of linear time. And even with what I would eventually need upon learning only 18 months later of the deadly return of my husband's own previously vanquished cancer. His diagnosis a harbinger of a literally unspeakable loss that would leave my brain feeling as if one of its hemispheres had been removed. I have this moment in which I am reminded that all of our words, all of our languages, these splendid palaces that inevitably fall into ruin, exist for only one thing. I have this moment into which my brother's life is compressed. This moment of him and Oliver passing the word love back and forth between them until there's nothing more to be said and Vec steers his small boat into the great silence.
Julie, thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. No, your podcast is so beautiful, and I'm just really grateful that you're taking the time to devote to this book.
Julie's edit of his book is called Linguaphile, A Life of Language Love. If you want to hear more about her life and how language has played such a key part in it, well, check out an earlier subtitle episode called A Mother Tongue Reclaimed. That mother tongue is Czech, and it was Julie's first language. I'll link to that episode in the show notes, and I'll also link to Julie's books. Thanks to Alison Shao, she writes our newsletter and manages social media, and thanks to you for listening and sticking with the podcast when there hasn't exactly been a ton of new material. All I can say is listen on. The dam will burst next year, and you'll be swimming in episodes. In the meantime, check out some of the other podcasts in the Hub and Spoke Audio Network. We at Subtitle are so happy to be able to recommend these podcasts. No one's twisting our arms because they're all fantastic listens. And guess what? There's a new one on the block. It's called Turning Corners. And that title, it's a play on the idea of making progress in the Four Corners region of the American Southwest. The way host Wade Rausch describes it, people in that part of the U.S. are bridging cultures and righting historical wrongs, or starting to, with a uniquely Southwestern type of courage and public spirit, along with a can-do, no-bullshit attitude. I love the first episode about a new exhibit at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It confronts tensions between indigenous artists and the Anglo artistic establishment represented by O'Keeffe. Search for Turning Corners wherever you're listening to this, or find it at the Hub and Spoke website, hubspokeaudio.org. I'll be back with another episode soonish. Until then, stay safe.
Hub and Spoke. Audio Collective.